is Steve Sherlock with another internet radio show or podcast number 157 in the series for Franklin Matters. This recording shares the Second Sunday Speaker Series presentation given on Sunday, January 13 in 2019. Franklin historian Alan Earls talks on When Terrorism Struck Franklin, February 28, 1919. The show notes on Franklin Matters will include the presentation document so you can follow along. The total recording, presentation, and Q&A runs about 55 minutes. Without further ado, here is the audio recording.
So hello and welcome everybody to the Franklin Historical Museum. I know that many of you have been here for our second Sunday speaker series in the past, and I appreciate you coming out, and I'm sure that everyone has T-bowed the game.
Yep.
And I think I said this last time, but they'll win or they'll lose whether we're watching or not. So, and Alan said, I think it's a 12-minute presentation.
Correct.
It's a one-hour presentation, so you'll be able to see the second half of the game. So thank you very much. This is a really interesting topic. I think you've seen in the news that it's also the 100-year anniversary of the molasses flood in Boston, which is amazing, the dark tide. A few years ago was the book that the library read. What do we call that? I'm sorry.
The One Book, One Community.
The community read, and it was really fascinating. So this is the 100-year anniversary. They thought that, well, I don't want to give away too much. So it's also the 100-year anniversary of the bombing in Franklin, which we, so many people who I think were up here are aware of it. But some of you, it might be news, and Alan has all of the details, and I'll turn it over to Alan. Thank you very much again for coming.
Thank you, Mary. A caveat, an apology, it's a complicated story. When I suggested the topic to Mary several months ago, noticing that it was the 100th anniversary coming up, I thought, well, you know, I'll pull up a few newspapers and I'll be able to summarize it like that. Well, every aspect of this has more aspects and more aspects in it. It's turned into a 65-slide presentation, which is only scratching the surface. So I'm going to do my best to make that coherent and interesting, but if you have any question at any point, if I'm not making sense, please just raise your hand or holler or interrupt, and we'll try to go from there. Okay, if this were February 28th, 1919, nearly a century ago, and it was the evening, maybe around 8:30 at night, you would have heard a tremendous explosion if you were in Franklin or indeed in the neighboring town. And I got a great comment from Gino Carlucci, the town's grant writer, who said his grandparents were sitting in the Morse Theater at that time when they felt the explosion go off. And they didn't hug each other immediately or anything like that because his future mother-in-law was sitting between them to make sure there was no hanky-panky. That just tells you how much times have changed. In any case, the next morning when you woke up, you would have seen stories like this in the Boston newspapers and locally. Pretty much the farther away from Franklin you got, the bigger the disaster became. There were not 10 houses destroyed, as the smaller story shows there, but four men were killed. And some of the descendants of those men are still in our town, and one relative is, I know, with us today. So it's a very human subject, ultimately, as well as being connected to big global events. What basically happened is that this building on the right, you can see in this contemporary postcard, the Ray Woolen Mill, which became part of the American Woolen Company, or before this date, was on strike, and there it is today. And four men attempted to go to the back section there. The pointer, I don't think, is working very well, but I'll try. Nah, it doesn't work. The top area where it says sugar beet, people who were the bombers lived in that general area, and they cached some dynamite in a pigsty behind in some low, swampy ground. And the attempt to create or move the bomb, something went wrong, and they were all killed, and the building survived. But it created a lot of consternation, as you might imagine. So I'm going to try to talk about who the bombers were, something about their motivation, the politics, the global events that were connected to this, the local events, and a little bit about the individuals and families involved, to the extent that I've been able to find that. Someone did a great interview with Concetta Tichelis, the widow of one of the four men killed around 1980. and she describes her being born in Lanciano in Italy. Her father had already come to America, and he invited them or paid for them to come to Franklin to get a job. And here she met her future husband, Silverio de Cellis, and became an anarchist along with him. And in the course of that, they met fellow anarchist, Sacco, of Sacco and Vanzetti fame, who lives in Hopedale, and went to plays and were friendly with his wife and family, and so on and so forth. Right after the bombing, we'll come back to that. Needless to say, she was, oh, thank you. No, you know, I haven't turned it on, that's the problem. Okay, oh. Friends, Romans, countrymen, how's that, better?
Yeah.
Thank you. The broad background, and again, this could fill many, many books, is what was going on in the world. The 19th century was a time of dramatic change everywhere. Agriculture was globalized through new transportation systems, railroads, steamships. They improved with mechanization. People in Europe could get grain grown in Australia or in America. So there was huge displacement of farmers all over Europe. Industry grew and became more powerful. There was, to some extent, a concentration of wealth, much like has happened recently, which created a lot of unrest and a lot of interest in things like the International Workers of the World, the big socialist organization, shown in this cartoon to the left, and the anarchists, excuse me, with their representative black flag. I think most of us are fairly familiar with socialism and the idea of the state operating things, excuse me. The state operating things and keeping some of the basic mechanisms we're familiar with in society, but putting it under a different form of control. Anarchists were, excuse me, a bit different. They, as I understand it, maybe I don't understand it, essentially proposed that the goodness of human nature would make everything work just fine if we got rid of all the structures, all forms of wealth, all forms of private control and ownership, all forms of government. And it would all just be one big, happy Woodstock-type party, I guess. I'm sure it's a little more complicated than that, but that's what I take away from it. So, many anarchists believe that in order to get to the state, you had to foment some kind of revolution. And they, I think one of the leading theorists had this thing called the propaganda of the deed, where you do something dramatic and violent to shake society, mostly aimed at people in power, like these eight heads of state who were assassinated from 1881 to 1914, including our own President William McKinley. I'm sure Teddy Roosevelt was a big fan of anarchism. Also in the United States, pretty famously, there was a big, big strike against the Carnegie Steel Corporation in the Western Pennsylvania area. And it was a very bitter strike. There was a lot of violence. The strikers were confronted by the Pinkerton Guards and eventually state militia, and there was fighting back and forth, and quite a few workers were killed, as well as some of the Pinkertons. In any case, Emma Goldman, a very famous anarchist, and her lover, Alex Berkman, who were living in Worcester, right up the street from us at the time, heard about this. Supposedly, Emma came rushing home with the headline, just said, "Homestead!" And with that call to arms, Berkman went off to Western Pennsylvania to try to rally the troops and really create a revolution. When that didn't get off the ground, he figured he should just do the next best thing, which was assassinate Henry Clay Frick, the lead man for Carnegie Steel, which he was unsuccessful in doing, and he spent the rest of his life pretty much in prison, I believe. Okay, I'm jumping on a bit, I apologize. One of the key anarchist figures in the United States was Luigi Galliani, who was born in Italy, and right away, when he graduated from law school and became an anarchist, he started getting in trouble with the authorities. He fled to France, he was thrown out of France, I think he was thrown out of Switzerland, went back to Italy, ended up being essentially exiled to Pantelleria, a little tiny island south of Sicily, which is sort of like a prison colony. And it was there he met his future wife, and they plotted their escape together, and eventually ended up in the United States. He was active in New Jersey, Vermont, I think Canada also, and started a radical newspaper which was widely read. Thousands of copies are sold every week, called Chronica Sorvervini, I think. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, which basically means Subversive Chronicle and Subversive News. His followers were known as Gallianists, and as you know, I said he ended up in Lynn, and then right down the street here in Wrentham. So he will figure rather prominently in our story as we go along. The newspaper not only had, you know, suggestions about how to organize and how to do this and that, but it also had many times detailed explanations in Italian for how to make a bomb or other useful items like that that would help you begin this revolution. And as I mentioned, he lived right down the road in Wrentham with his wife and their children. I think she had one child prior to the marriage, and then they had several more together. And again, I mentioned the Sacklers lived right up the street. So these kinds of things were the background. In 1913, the Draper Company, which I think they thought they were benign capitalists, and they probably were in most ways, although you can never satisfy everyone, they had sprung out of the idealist community that created Hopedale in the 1840s and 50s, and they worked to provide proper worker housing and so on and so forth, what they thought were good pay and so on. But a strike happened nonetheless. And somewhere along the way, a worker was killed in the strike, which failed. In that time, the friends of the bombers here in Franklin were friends with these people and were trying to support them. I don't think they did anything beyond that. So we're up to the teens and 20s. We have a world that's already tense. There's international differences that ultimately led to World War I, economic differences that lead to this tendency towards socialism and anarchism in some of the less well-off people, and capitalism, if you want to call it that, among the wealthier. And then, you know, the stress of World War I came along, and then the Russian Revolution. So all of this radicalism really got supercharged, especially the Russian Revolution. A lot of people thought, okay, this is it. The whole world's going to go through a revolution, and we're going to all become anarchists or communists or something. During this time, Galliani opposed the American involvement in the war, much to his, which raised his attention of him with the authorities. His slogan was against war, against peace, for revolution. Some of the related effects that were happening in the United States, there were big instances of sabotage by German agents or sympathizers, a gigantic munitions explosion in New Jersey, some sabotage by radicals and raiding of radicals, the Wobblies, the IWWs, and anarchists by the authorities. And the Wilson administration just essentially got rid of civil liberties for the duration, and all kinds of people, even people who were just a little bit, you know, not in favor of the war, ended up in prison or having their rights taken away. And immigrants in particular, and that was to some extent Galliani's slogan, many of them had come here to escape the draft. They didn't want to be in the European countries where everybody had to serve the army. The United States didn't have that at the time. We'd been happily at peace since the end of the Civil War, and people thought by coming here they could escape that, but not so much, as it turned out. At the end of the war, as this age of sort of radicalism was upon us, there were people who were very concerned that the unrest might actually spread to American troops. So they created the American Legion with the hope of taking the energy and the identity veterans had and turning it into something less radical and somewhat more patriotic. Everyone with me so far? I told you I was going to wander all over the place with this. I do want to just share one bit of reading. About 6 months ago, I happened to read the novel 1919, which is part of a trilogy by John Dos Passos, about that rough era of change in America. And there was one little conversation in this novel that seemed to summarize the feeling of the times, I think. One of the main characters in this sprawling novel is a fellow named Joe, who's a disaffected United States sailor who jumped ship when they were in Argentina, and he's now joined the Merchant Marine. He's sort of bumming around, and he's in New York City looking for a job, happens to go into a bar. Everything happens when you go into a bar, right? Joe gets talking to two guys from Chicago who were drinking whiskey and beer chasers. They said this war talk was a lot of bourgeois propaganda, and if working stiffs stopped working in munitions factories making shells to knock the working stiffs' blocks off around the world, there'd be no damn war. Joe said they were goddamn right, but look at the big money you made. The guys from Chicago said they'd been working in munitions factories themselves, but they were through, goddammit, and that if the working stiffs made a few easy dollars, it meant the war profiteers were making easy millions. They said the Russians had the right idea.
make a revolution, shoot the goddamn profiteers. And that would happen in this country, too, if they didn't watch out. And a damn good thing, too. So, again, fictional and just a slice of life, but it really was a time of great tension in our country and the world. So, end of the war. All this radicalism in the world, the Russian Revolution is sort of an ongoing process. Some American troops are over there sort of trying to tap it down a little bit, as well as British and French troops. And what happens? Mary mentioned the molasses explosion, the gigantic tank of molasses that burst in the north end and killed dozens of people. 11 dead, pardon me, I'm exaggerating. And many people initially thought that was the result of radicals. It was an Italian neighborhood where there were plenty of radicals there. The long-run view is that probably wasn't the case. It was just a badly designed tank and a company that probably overfilled it, causing it to be stressed. And then actual radical things, the first and possibly the only general strike in the United States in which all the unions in Seattle, and at that time unions covered almost everybody, or at least a very large part of the working occupations. So the city was at a standstill because of that. And then, somewhere in this time, I don't know the exact date, but Galliani, because of all his activities, was earmarked for deportation, which at the time was a complicated process. He wasn't yet a citizen, but there was the existing laws made it difficult to deport someone who had children here or who lived here for six or more years. In any case, that was in the offing. And Galliani and some of his supporters, including the bombers from Franklin, apparently traveled to Taunton on February 26th or 7th for what the police thought was some kind of a rally or conspiracy meeting to do something, but which supposedly was just actually a social occasion. All his friends got together to party and wish him well and, you know, toast the future of the revolution. But perhaps inspired by all that good talk, with the strike still going on back in Franklin at the Ray Mill, something really bad happened in this general vicinity, this low ground between McCarthy Street, the mill behind Sugar Beet and Ray Hill Road, and where the DPW headquarters is. There was a pigsty where these men had kept their cache of bomb-making material, and something went wrong. Some people think it was a timer that was misset or miswired, or who knows, but you know, it's like the old thing, you play with fire, you're gonna get burned, you play with dynamite, something bad could happen. Again, I'm gonna try to switch gears and focus a little bit on what happened afterward. And let me quote again from the widow DeCellis. In February 1919, there was a strike in Franklin at the factory where my husband worked. He and three other men decided to put a bomb in the factory. They were determined to shut it down. I was at home and heard the explosion. We lived quite near the factory. All the dishes fell from the cupboard and broke. The bomb had gone off prematurely. All four men were killed. My husband, his older brother, and two comrades, all young men in their 20s. In no time, the town was filled with police. Everywhere you saw police. Policemen hanging from trees. Soon after the explosion, they came and arrested me. I was his wife, and they wanted information. They held me for 3 or 4 months. They questioned me and questioned me, but I told them nothing. If you don't talk, we will deport you, they said. And then she continues, many of the Italian women kept to their old beliefs, but many were also very active and radicalized, as she was. So where did all this happen? You saw the picture earlier of the building that they were attempting to bomb, and it was right near Sugar Beet Road, a very short road, which connects to Ray Hill Road, shown here. I was mentioning earlier to someone that the street numbers quoted in the old newspaper articles don't seem to match the current ones, but clearly it was the same houses, same street, and houses weren't destroyed. So one of these houses, or two of these houses, actually contained the bombers. They lived there. And to the left, behind the houses you see on your left, the ground goes down much lower. And it was behind there that the bomb went off. And supposedly bits of people were thrown all over the street and even as far as Sugar Beet, maybe even Union. You can see how close the house that I just showed you is to the factory in this photograph. So who were these people? One was James Tarzan or Terzin. His name is quoted different ways in different articles. I've not been able to find anything more about him anywhere. he's kind of a mystery. He had come in from Lawrence a short time before this happened, where there was a long history of labor unrest. He's presumed to have been carrying the bomb since, in one of the more graphic accounts, they talk about the chief looking at the wooden box that contained his remains, and it's just basically two legs from below the knee and nothing else. The other people were presumably a little further away, and there were sometimes bigger body parts around. Mike Donello, some of you may know, he grew up in town and moved off, but he still is in the area. He says his uncle or granduncle, I can't remember which uncle, I think, was one of the people hired to go hunt for body parts, I don't know, like a nickel a piece or something, on that cleanup and that investigation. Domenico Palumbo was another of the boarders, of the bombers, who at the time was boarding in Ray Row before he was married and subsequently married Angelina Sacco. I don't think related to the Sacco, Vanzetti Sacco. He was also killed. And as I mentioned in the little footnote, and we'll talk more about this later, subsequent to this, his wife remarried someone else named Palumbo, I'm guessing perhaps a brother-in-law, and they lived in town and had more children, and some of their descendants are still in town today. Silvario De Cellis, I was talking about him and his wife, the person who was interviewed, was another of the people killed. This is his draft card, I believe. And likewise, the older brother, Eustachio De Cellis. And the only death certificate I found was for Eustachio. He was apparently buried in this City Mills Green Street Cemetery over toward the Norfolk side of town. My sons and I walked this cemetery about a month ago, and we couldn't find any markings. I'm assuming they were just, you know, given pauper's grave treatment. All of them probably ended up here, since all of them, I think, were atheists and not practicing Catholics or anything else, so probably no one else wanted them, at least that's my assumption. Some of the other aftermaths, I mentioned James Tarzan was from Lawrence. Given that connection, the people in Lawrence, or the authorities of Lawrence, were worried to death. They had the mills under armed guard with an order to shoot anyone that came near the mills who wasn't authorized, period. And similarly in Franklin, the Ray Mill and probably some of the others had hired watchmen 24 hours a day. A few days after the bombing, some fellow came out of the woods, probably inebriated or looking for his way home or something, but when they challenged him, he ran off and they shot at him and didn't get him. But that shows the kind of tension that was going on in the community at the time. And then nationally, this connects to all kinds of things. The bombing in Franklin, I don't think, was in any way intended to be the start of a campaign. It seemed to be just people acting independently. And that was one of the potent things about the anarchists. They didn't have to coordinate. It was a little bit like we hear about ISIS, you know, just people who sympathize with ISIS going off and slashing people or burning things or blowing things up or shooting down an airplane or whatever. In any case, shortly thereafter, a whole series of Galleanist events began to occur. 36 mail bombs were sent to prominent Americans. I don't think any of the prominent Americans were killed, but some of their servants were, or badly injured, including Attorney General Palmer, who'd been running Wilson's domestic surveillance and suppression program and was controversial in some circles. And this made him mad as a hornet, I suspect. Then in June, 8 more bigger bombs went off. All of them had this message attached. War, class war, and you were the first to wage it under the cover of the powerful institutions you call order in the darkness of your laws. There will have to be bloodshed. We will not dodge. There will have to be murder. We will kill because it is necessary. There will have to be destruction. We will destroy to rid the world of your tyrannical institutions. And again, the results were one watchman was killed and one of Galliani's supporters who was trying to again bomb the Attorney General was killed when the bomb went off prematurely. And to top it all, we had our pre-9/11 big attack on Wall Street, September 16th, 1920. Again, Galleanists, 38 people killed, more than 100 injured. You can see some of the results here in these old photographs. And again, a Galliani friend, and friend of Sacco and Vanzetti, Buddha, wrote for Cronaca Soverica, Galliani's newspaper. He was never proven to have been the mastermind, but I think most authorities thought he probably was. They just couldn't convict him or couldn't even charge him, perhaps. And on the right, just because I needed a place to put it, there's an image of some of the stone on Wall Street that's still pockmarked from these explosions. And again, this doesn't relate directly to to Franklin, but things that were going on at the same time, the so-called Centralia Massacre in Washington State. Legionnaires have been marching to celebrate the year anniversary of the end of World War I. They happened to go by the IWW Socialist Hall, and I think the implication is that they attacked them to get to, they didn't like these unpatriotic Americans. In any case, the IWW people were armed and dangerous. They shot several of the Legionnaires. There was a pitched battle that went on for a while, and ultimately they caught one of the people who had a gun and had done some shooting. Whether he actually killed anyone or not, I don't think anyone knows. This Wesley Everest, who was a IWW member, and he was really brutally tortured, lynched, beaten, everything. And of course, nobody was punished for that. But it was just, you know, really chaotic state of affairs in the country at the time. And speaking of Palmer, there had been all kinds of raids going on, but they really geared up in November 1919 for the next few months, the so-called Palmer raids, when they went just door to door and grabbed all kinds of people that were actual anarchists, actual radicals, actual socialists, or just suspected anarchists or socialists. The laws, as I mentioned, weren't always very helpful for the authorities trying to capture or detain or get rid of folks that were deemed potentially dangerous. But the essence of the Palmer raids was to just get people and to the hell with the law, you know, put them on a boat and send them out of the country before anyone could complain. So there was a lot of that. A lot of it was extra legal and probably not the high point of American justice. But you know, given the situation, it's not surprising that people wanted to just do what needed doing. Our good friend J. Edgar Hoover, who most people over a certain age will remember fondly as the head of the FBI, or not, was very involved with this. Mike DiNello, I mentioned earlier, who grew up here, believes, based on oral tradition, that John Hoover, J. Edgar, was in charge of the roundups in this area. I don't know if that's true. I haven't been able to establish that for sure or not. But he said, characteristically, his father and his uncle, as he was growing up in the 40s and 50s, if the news program, a radio broadcast, or a TV show would come on and mention J. Edgar Hoover, they would turn in unison, spit on the ground, because you know, that he had come through and scooped up a lot of other folks from the Italian-American community without much regard to whether they were really guilty or not, breaking up families and what have you, and shipping them off never to be seen again. This cartoon sort of explains that dilemma, the efforts by some authorities to throw radicals out of the country, but the fact that they couldn't, and they just keep coming right back in or not actually leave, which was led to the Palmer raids and their attempts to circumvent the situation. And again, not directly related to our bombing, but socialism was such a big deal. I guess that's not such a big news right now, where we have a number of avowedly socialist nationally known candidates. But at the time, this was pretty exceptional. Eugene Debs had stood up against World War I, and Wilson and company promptly put him in prison, from where he campaigned for the presidency in 1920. And he didn't get a huge vote, but he got 6% in Plymouth County. And I know it was much higher. I couldn't find the exact number, but I think I read somewhere it was about 12 or 15% of the vote in Brockton, which was a big socialist stronghold. So it just shows you how divided people were then, not unlike now, I guess one could suggest, but interesting nonetheless. And again, in this climate of, you know, social unrest, to say the least, there was a payroll robbery in April 1920 at the Slater and Morrill factory, and two people were killed, Frederick Parmenter and Alessandro Berardelli. The people ultimately blamed for it, and this will probably remain controversial for the duration of history, were Vanzetti and Sacco. Sacco we've already met, and Vanzetti was a friend, a fellow Italian, certainly a sympathizer, but apparently a less active member of the anarchist or socialist groups. And again, in response to what the Palmer raids were trying to do, this sense that a whole lot of radicalized immigrant people were wandering around America threatening its institutions, the immigration limit was put in the early to mid-20s which capped new immigration initially at 3% of any given ethnic group's portion of the 1910 census, which is shown in this little cartoon. And after much, much controversy and years of appeals, Sacco and Vanzetti were ultimately executed for that crime in 1927. It attracted global attention. I think Governor Dukakis issued a pardon at some point in the 70s, claiming that they were not fairly tried, which is probably in part true, although modern ballistics tests of the weapon in question seem to point to it, in fact, being Sacco's gun. And Vanzetti's situation is less clear, but there's certainly significant evidence that Sacco was a guilty party. Vanzetti, perhaps not so much. And Vanzetti actually had pretty good alibis of people he was supposedly with in North End. He was a fish dealer. He moved around. People saw him. But that didn't float too well with the judicial system, and particularly Judge Webster Thayer, who was pretty, well, unsympathetic, I guess would be a gentle way of putting it. He, Mike Dinello, again, he's a very sharp fellow. He actually read 1,000 pages of the testimony of this trial, and he's come to some pretty good conclusions about Thayer. He said, you know, Thayer was subtly sarcastic, would just cut off debate and not let certain bits of information in. And he was quoted by a Boston Globe reporter or Herald reporter as saying after the execution, did you see what I did to those anarchistic bastards the other day? And there were quite a few other comments like that that he made over the years that indicated that he was essentially the hanging judge. And again, it's indeed possible at least one of the men was guilty, but there was a definite rush to judgment. People in authority were, in many cases, thoroughly fed up with all this goings on and bombings, and you know, someone was going to get punished by God. however, the Gallianists were still active, so a few years later, the judge's house was blown to bits, and I think his housekeeper was injured or possibly killed. And thereafter, he spent the rest of his life, a few more years, living in a private men's club in Boston with an armed guard all the time. Excuse me. Again, I'm going to shift gears because it's a complicated story. Here in town, we have the Sons of Italy. It's a national organization. There's a local chapter. Some of you may be members or may know people who are members. I think it's telling that it was founded in 1928, almost 10 years after the four Italian-Americans had attempted to commit this anarchistic act. And it was named Four Heroes after the four Italian-Americans who had actually died in the service of their country, quote unquote, during World War I. Obviously honoring them, but I think maybe an attempt by the Italian-American community to say, it's not all of us, the rest of us are red-blooded, you know, we're on board with the rest of America, don't look at us. And as I mentioned, some people did indeed stay. Mrs. Palumbo remarried. Her son, Christy, graduated from Franklin High School in 1929. At least according to the yearbook, he was heading off to Fitchburg Normal, Fitchburg State, in other words. And I know he lived here in town for a long time. My wife's family was friends with him. He was a guest at Christmas parties. Someone told me he was involved, ended up working in the textile business, recycling fibers from factories and reselling them to different people that needed them. He raised a family here. And, you know, somehow the community re-accepted people, and many people just went on. However, what's been interesting to me in looking into this, I've talked to lots of folks from the town, especially people of Italian-American heritage, and I've been surprised at how many people were not aware of this. Some people were just shocked when I told them this story, even though you would have expected them to have heard it, but other people were aware of it. But I think there was a kind of a selective memory. People just, in many cases, didn't want to remember this or be reminded of it because it was a, whether you agreed or not with the people, it still was a burden for the community to kind of exist with other non-Italian anarchists and explain yourself. So I think that's why there's sort of a selective repression of the topic. Meanwhile, our friend Luigi, just before he was actually deported in June of 1919, two of his children, I think they're both girls, graduated from Wrentham High School. You know, they had a pretty normal life despite being the center of this anarchistic effort. And I got a kick out of this. I just happened to discovered by accident. Kosira Liberty Galliani. Kosira is the Greek name for the island where he was exiled for so long. So it's the, you know, the place of exile and then liberty in the name of his child. After he was exiled, the family struggled to survive. I guess they got some help from local anarchists. His eldest daughter, Ilia Galliani, continued to work on behalf of anarchist causes, went to medical school, and became an early advocate of various forms of birth control, and had an office and a sort of clinic in the back bay, shown in this photograph. Several times the place was raided by people because all of that was illegal at the time. But she persisted, as they say, until the mid-1950s. I think she died in the early mid-1970s. Mrs. DeCellis, Steve's aunt, worked as a seamstress in the 1950s at Priscilla's of Boston, along with another anarchist who spent time in prison for carrying dynamite for somebody, some explosion project in New Jersey. And the two of them made high fashion clothing, including, I guess it was actually Grace Kelly's wedding dress, which seems so incongruous to me. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but that's me. Somebody else. Later generations tend to remember some parts of this and sometimes forget, as I mentioned. Christy, the son that went to Franklin High School, has passed away in the early 90s. His son, who served in Vietnam, passed away actually before him. And I know there are grandchildren around the parts as well. And then, again, in some circles, the Sacco and Vanzetti people are held up as martyrs, and they just bring tears to the eyes of people. But in Braintree, not so much, because that's where these people were murdered. So they see it very differently. In 1910, they created a monument, or a marker to this. And as you can see, two grandsons of Frederick Parmenter, one of the people killed in that event, sit in a cage where the two men were tried in the 1920s. They even had a parade with 1920s cars. And I think I mentioned earlier, Sean Sears, the grandson of Luigi Galliani, now teaches Marxism and related philosophical topics in the University of Kent. His mother, who was the youngest daughter of Galliani, in addition to maintaining her, I think she became a communist because it was probably more convenient, more in step with the times in the 20s and 30s. But she ended up marrying this Michael Sayers, who was a quite prominent author and playwright in the UK, but also very left-wing. And he came to the United States, and I forgot exactly what specific thing he got in trouble for in the 40s, but when the McCarthy era came along, they were persona non grata. He was blacklisted, couldn't work in Hollywood, couldn't do this to that. So he went back to the UK, and that's where Sean grew up. And I've been exchanging emails with him. It's been very helpful, pointing me towards some things. Someone in Italy just recently wrote a biography of Galliani, which is currently only available in Italian, which I unfortunately can't read, but it's going to be translated soon. Sean wrote a preface for it in English, which he was kind enough to send me, which discusses the path his family took subsequent to this, and his various views on the subject. One of the interesting things about it, let's see if I can put my finger on this, he mentions his mother's early memory of her father. She really didn't see him for very long because he was deported when she was 10 or so. But he's speaking of his mother. He says, "My mother was always very proud of them. She then became a communist, even if there's an often degree of hostility among anarchists and communists." She remembers this particular instance. When my father was about to be deported, my parents were fighting, and my mother asked him, "Why don't you tell them you don't believe in anarchism anymore?" I will never forget his reaction, which presumably was negative. "Now I'm happy that he lived his life he intended in, always believing in the cause." So, strangely, this is the strangest of all to me, roughly where Luigi's backyard was, his home, the remains of his home are in the woods, a very short distance from this. So where he was once preaching revolution, we now have this temple to capitalism and consumerism. So far, it's not working for him. So, yeah, and anarchism still has its adherents, I should note. This is from a year or so ago in Providence. I don't know, not my cup of tea. So I think I may have gone through that a little faster than I intended. I'm happy to discuss further, take questions, try to fill in blanks. And if anyone like Steve in the back row wants to share any stories, that would be great. But thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
No questions. It's going to be a quiz. Yes.
What do you think the Italians were so involved with the anarchists? Were there other groups that were involved? Or
I don't think it was purely an Italian thing. I don't know quite why, but you know, it wasn't only Italian anarchists. But in this area, maybe because they were the newest and lowest rung of immigrants, perhaps it was more appealing to them. I mean, I don't think there were many Irish anarchists at the time. The Irish were busy with other things, like freeing the home country and what have you. Steve, do you want to talk at all about your granddad, or we're not going to be able to persuade you?
I don't know.
Okay. I guess if there's no questions, it's time to go see Tom Brady, but I'm hoping to add to the story, because I feel terrible. I have to gloss over so much, probably not well, but there's just so much to the story, so many connections to individuals here, to the world. So thank you for the opportunity, Mary, and thank you for coming.
Thank you again, Steve.
One more question.
Yeah. Oh, I have another question down here.
Yep.
The anarchists, when they were going to the mill, to bomb the mill, and they blew themselves up, was it a day that people were working in the mill where a lot of people would have been killed?
Or? Well, no, because it was at night, and they were on strike, so the mill was closed at the time.
Okay.
So, again, the defense that many of the anarchists make is, in general, they weren't out to commit mass murder. They were out to target people or institutions that they felt were oppressive.
But the intent wasn't to kill all the people?
No, apparently. Although, I wondered if they maybe secretly didn't want to go kill the Ray family or something as the oppressors. I don't know. We'll never know that.
But it was nighttime.
So. Yeah, and according to his wife, it was nighttime, and they were intending to blow up the mill. So I guess we'll have to assume that was the case. Yeah.
Were they employed by the mill?
Yes, two of them worked at that mill. Two or maybe three, I think. Palumbo and both the Celluses. Tarzan, I don't know what his status was exactly. He was new to the area.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
The amount of dynamite obviously did a lot of damage to the four individuals in close proximity. Had they actually got it to their intended place, any idea of the amount of damage that would have been caused based on the amount of dynamite that they had?
I don't know much. The fair use picture I showed at the front of a few sticks of dynamite, I'm guessing it was probably like that. It wasn't like a truck bomb. Someone mentioned, I don't know on what basis, but they told me that the mill had recently installed a brand new expensive boiler, which would have been a fairly easy thing to put a bomb against and wreck it, so it didn't work well. So that may have been the target. At least that this person speculated that that was the case. But it probably wouldn't have flattened the building. It probably would have damaged the building, I suspect. I'm no explosives expert. Yeah.
So you said that the explosives were felt to be stored at this pig farm here, and that's what blew up, or?
At that time, a lot of working people would maintain a small little pigsty on the edge of town somewhere as a way to reuse food waste. And eventually, after 6 months or a year or 2 years, you go slaughter your piglet or pig. So this swampy ground, I don't know who owned it, but apparently there were at least one or two of these little pigsties there. And probably that seemed like a good place to hide things, maybe in the mud or under something, I don't know. But it wasn't an actual farm, it was just probably something maybe they even owned or used themselves.
And that's where the explosion occurred?
In that general vicinity, yes, yeah. Yes, Bob?
Did you get a sense in your research that it was the IWW that was the driving force for all this in town?
I don't think so. These people were all anarchists. I mean, there were a lot of IWW people around. There were about an equal number of IWW members in the Italian IWW club in Milford, and in the Italian Anarchist Club in Milford, many of whom worked at the Draper Mill. So I'm assuming it's probably similar here, but these people were all supposedly anarchists specifically, and probably particularly so because Galliani was so popular with them and so influential in this community at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just curious.
I'm sorry, but I came in late and I'm feeling stupid asking the question, but what does IWW say?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the International Workers of the World, sometimes abbreviated or derided as the Wobblies, is the nickname that they have. And they've been around for a century and a half, I guess, almost. Is that 125 years or something like that? And they have a pretty wide-ranging, fairly revolutionary creed, I think. But again, I'm not an expert on such things. Person in the back?
Yes, I take it that the strike was over wages and hours. And do you have any sense at all as to whether this particular mill paid worse or had worse hours than what else was in our area?
I don't know. Someone told me, probably just on the basis of surmise, that it was over a few cents, which might have been the case because wages were not that big at the time.
Yeah.
Most likely wages are being cut even, or at least certainly not raised, because with the end of World War One, demand everywhere had fallen off. The US and pretty much every other economy went into a kind of recession as the economy adjusted. So there wasn't a lot of inclination to raise wages, and people were probably actually, you know, in many cases thrown out of work during this time period. I don't know specifically what the situation was there, but I think it's probably fair to say that this wasn't exactly a, you know, dark, satanic mill like a Dickensian type of thing. These people lived in modest houses, but nice houses that are still being happily lived in today and sold for substantial sums of money compared to back then, you could be sure. And the town had just had a sanitary survey. I'm not quite sure who paid for it or why, but a sanitary engineer went around and looked at every aspect of the town, where trash was disposed of, looked at the water supplies, looked at how people lived in their homes, what kind of cleanliness was maintained in the schools. And he visited this mill, and he said, you know, he reported it clean, they had good places to wash up and, you know, take care of your food, and things were pretty safe. So I have no doubt these people sincerely had what they believed was a grievance, otherwise they wouldn't be waltzing around in the dark with sticks of dynamite. But objectively, I don't think it was, you know, the most horrifying place in the world. They just had a, you know, belief of the way history ought to move, and this was their the palette on which they wanted to work their magic, I guess you could say. Yeah.
How did they figure out who did the bombing if they were just body parts?
Well, I mean, they assumed, perhaps incorrectly, that this James Tarzan may have been carrying it because almost nothing was left of him above the waist. And the other people were all, I don't know how badly shattered. I've requested, you know, any reports on that from archives, but I haven't been able to get a response yet. But, you know, they do know that they were involved. And one of the things they did subsequently was go out and raid a lot of these homes. And in the home, the Cellis home particularly, supposedly they came away with, like, you know, a truckload of things that had been taken from the mill, because that was part of the credo too. Anything you could do to, you know, punish the people in power, take a bolt of cloth, take a tool, anything. You know, it's your job to undo them. And plus, lots and lots of literature in Italian, and I think also in Polish. And there were apparently raids related to this in Woonsocket and Attleboro, because, you know, obviously these kinds of activists were everywhere in these towns. And there was a fear that this was, you know, a general rebellion. Is this going to be the Massachusetts Revolution part two or what? So there was lots and lots of knocking on doors and people going away in the nights and investigations. Yes?
Do you have a sense of what the ethnic makeup of the town was?
Someone can correct me, and please do if you know. I would guess it was probably 30%, 25, 30% Italian at the time, and maybe another 20% Irish, and maybe a few Armenians were starting to come into the town at that point, and the rest probably, you know, what you might broadly call a Yankee, or at least more native-born people. But I don't know, that's a guess, so if anyone can correct that, please do. But the Italians had become a pretty substantial portion of the community in that area of town, especially.
Sorry if I'm late, if you covered it.
No, I'll be back. Go ahead.
Do you have a sense of the police investigative response or effectiveness in the immediate? Is it town police, state police?
It was town police, something called the State Guard. I don't know if that was the euphemism for the state police or if it was the actual Army Guard. I haven't been able to figure that out yet, but they had a lot of people here. As Mrs. DiCella said, police hanging from trees, looking at things. I'm sure this attracted a lot of attention. You know, it was long before there were real scientific methods of investigation, but this was low-hanging fruit. They had the radical literature. The people were known to be radicals. Their bodies were there. There was remains of dynamite and probably some additional testimony, but it didn't go beyond that, I don't think. And Mrs. DiCellis, in her interview in the 80s, mentioned that after she was released by the police, you know, everyone in town would just like point her out, a woman in black. She couldn't stand it. She had one child who was, I think, 7 months old, quite young. She said she'd go to the train station and people say, oh, there she goes, or that's her. And she finally quite naturally got sick and tired of that and moved to Malden, where she had friends or relatives. And actually, Sacco's wife moved either in with her or was a neighbor during Sacco's trial, so there's a kind of a community of people finding ways to survive or prosper on the periphery of all this. Yeah?
A question about your source material. Did you go to all local repositories, or did you contact any of the major labor repositories?
Major what?
Labor therapy.
No, I have not done that. That's a really good idea. I did stumble, I think, on one labor source. Again, mostly, you know, Googling.
NYU has a very large labor history region.
Who's that?
NYU.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I may have bumped into that at some point in my Googling, but a lot of it was Googling newspaper databases, a few books that have touched on this, as I mentioned. But this book on the left, Anarchist Voices, has the interview with Mrs. DiCellis. That was fascinating because it's, you know, very much first person. And thanks to Vicki for finding the book, my dear wife. But yeah, just a really interesting story, and I hope it made some sense.
I hope that, yes. Dr. Giuliani, did she live in Needham? Did she have an office?
Mm-hmm. Ilya Giuliani? Galliani? What I read said that she was primarily in Boston, but she did have some Needham connection. There were people that lived in Needham, so maybe she stopped practicing around 1953, I think, or maybe a little later, at least that I could tell. Again, I'm just scratching the surface and trying to put the pieces together on this, so I'm sure I've missed a whole lot.
So it was much like it is today. They would send their organizers around to all of the major industrial complexes on the East Coast, in order to pass out pamphlets and have our meetings.
And I think it was a pretty receptive audience, apparently. Yeah.
So it wasn't just localized.
No,
a broad network.
Right. And he published the newspaper while he was in Vermont. I think he started it while he was in Vermont, but he published it from Lynn, and I think it survived him as well. Sacco was a contributor, I think I mentioned that in one of the slides.
All set?
Thanks, folks.
All right. Well,
Thank you.
This was the first of our second Sunday speaker series. Second Sunday of every month, hopefully, this year. The list will come out in February newspapers. And as you know, the admission to the museum is always free, but donations are always accepted. So thank you very much, and everybody have a great afternoon.
This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but I can't do it alone. I can always use your help. How can you help? In particular, if you have an interest in real estate, zoning, or construction, I would like somebody to follow the Planning Board, Zoning Board of Appeals, and or the Conservation Committee meetings. I'll provide guidance on note-taking and sharing. You need to bring an inquisitive and open mind and willingness to learn and share. Overall, if you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like this, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana. Copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008 and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.